Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop and goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Real food, green living.
Real food, green living.
Earth Eats.
Earth Eats.
Happy day after Thanksgiving, everyone. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in. In anticipation of being completely sick of turkey, stuffing, and mashed potatoes, we've decided to do a show all about local winemaking today. The folks at the Oliver Winery were good enough to open up their facilities to us, so we'll be following some grapes from the vine to the bottle. Cheers! But first, here's Liz Leslie with a look at this week's news.
The Freaky Fast Farm Bill has slammed to a halt, and there is increased scrutiny on BPA and canned foods. It's all in this week's food news. The failure of the bipartisan super committee to build a budget stalled the 2012 Farm Bill. The Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction came to an agreement, lawmakers said in the statement, but because the larger budget has not been solidified, work on the Farm Bill will not continue at this time. Looking to avoid BPA? The chemical is found in certain plastics and the lining of canned goods. Evidence has shown large amounts of BPA can cause hormonal changes, and young children and infants are especially vulnerable. The Journal of the American Medical Association released a study this week finding high levels of BPA in canned soup. However, it's unclear if increased levels are damaging to health. You can read more news updates and get the latest in food news on our website, eartheats.org, and be sure to keep an eye on our Twitter feed and on our Facebook page. Just search for Earth Eats. For Earth Eats, I'm Liz Leslie.
America's bats are in trouble. In parts of the northeastern U.S., their numbers have decreased by 97%. Now, researchers are bracing for the possibility of massive population declines in the Midwest as well. And as Harvest Public Media's Tim Lloyd reports, losing a big portion of Mother Nature's pest control crew could prove costly to farmers.
Shelley Cox scaled a rusty metal gate and made her way toward a small creek lined by hollow trees. It's the favorite hangout for her summer guests, migrating bats.
I come down here and sit.
Cox and her husband farm 86 acres just outside of Savannah, Missouri. And she's kind of got a soft spot for what she calls nature's underdogs.
They're huge at insect control. Like I was saying, if you come in and you use insecticides as pesticides every single year, they are not species specific. So they're not just killing that target insect that's harming your crops. They're killing all insects. Well, if you're wiping out all the insects, you're wiping out the bat population. It's kind of one of those vicious cycles. How much money do you want to spend on pesticides?
And it's worked for you so far.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, in 15 years, we've used pesticides twice. So, yeah, it's been hugely beneficial.
But that could change soon, because the forecast for America's bat population isn't looking good.
You've already lost 70% of the bats that are hibernate in the northeastern U.S., and that includes New England and New York State.
Thomas Kuntz is a bat researcher at Boston University.
There are large colonies of bats in the Midwest. There's going to be some pretty massive die-offs there, I'd say, in 3 years.
So to get a handle on what a massive population decline might mean, Kuntz started running the numbers. Based on previous research he did in Texas, Kuntz paired estimates for how many bugs bats eat with crop data from the USDA. And here's what he came up with.
3.7 billion to 53 billion was what we published in the journal Science.
Yes, you did hear that correctly. Kuntz estimates bats could be worth up to $53 billion a year to America's farmers.
The dollar value is what bats save farmers in lowered pesticide use. So farmers would have to spend that much more on pesticides.
Okay, but let's take a big step back. What is killing all these bats? Well, it's mostly attributed to a very weird fungus that turns into something called white nose syndrome, named after the white face it gives bats. Once a bat has the fungus, it takes around 3 years to fully develop into white nose. And when it does, the effects are pretty nasty. Hibernating bats with the syndrome wake up often, fly around, and burn up their fat reserves. Deaths are mostly caused by simple exhaustion. As bad as white nose is, there's a lesser threat from an unexpected source, wind power. It's the reason why student researcher Janelle Bocock is holding one very cranky evening bat.
So the band number BRRA3317? All right.
What the student workers are doing today is doing a survey to determine if the endangered Indiana bat is present in an area that is slated to become a wind energy facility.
Lynn Robbins is a bat researcher at Missouri State University. He consults wind companies as to what threat a new facility might pose to the endangered Indiana bat.
And if they're here, then the wind company must take the next step in being more careful as to where they put their turbines or determine whether they're even going to put the turbines in the area.
The proposed wind farm would be built in northwest Missouri. Robbins, however, can't give the exact location because of contractual obligations. For reasons that remain unknown, bats are attracted to turbines that tower above tree lines. Once they're close, the pressure drop around the spinning blades can crush their lungs, or they can just get smacked by the spinning blades. And while the risk of killing an endangered Indiana bat might slam the brakes on a proposed wind farm, finding another species isn't likely to slow down a project. Ed Arnett is a researcher participating in the Bats Wind Energy Cooperative.
There's a gradient of contribution and acceptance of wildlife impacts and what companies are doing about it.
The effort Arnett is a part of brings together conservation groups, the American Wind Energy Association, and federal agencies. The idea is to pull together research that companies can use to sidestep killing bats at future wind facilities. And right now, every little effort helps. Back at Cox's farm, tucked in the hills of northwest Missouri, she's already noticed a change.
Well, we were seeing maybe like in a given evening, you might see a dozen or so swooping around the lights or something. And now, last year, we were seeing maybe, four or five. You know, I mean, you don't know whether to get worried or whether to think, okay, well, maybe I'm just not out here at the right time, or, you know, maybe I'm out here too early or I'm out here too late, or maybe they're down here foraging. If you don't really know what's going on, you hate to kind of be a catastrophizer and say, oh my gosh. But yes, I have noticed a difference, you know, in the number that I typically would see at the lights at night.
She says it would not shut down her operation if bats were to suddenly disappear, but they'd sure feel it. And with rising input costs on the farm, Cox says the money bats help her save goes a long way. Tim Lloyd, Harvest Public Media.
Read more from the folks at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
We're probably not going to be doing any wine tasting at 8:48 on a Tuesday, right?
You'd be surprised. Sometimes duty calls.
Fall at the Oliver Winery is a busy time of year with harvesting and grape prepping. This year has been especially interesting because warm temperatures and sunny days have elongated the harvest season. Pam Bonin, marketing manager at the winery, is serving as my tour guide today. We'll be following the journey of some Catawba grapes from the vine to the bottle.
This is a really unique time to be out here right now. It's harvest season, and so we are accepting fruit very often. So this is when we're actually stemming and crushing and pressing.
Picked a good time to come.
Picked a perfect time to come to the winery.
The story of Oliver Winery began in the 1960s with Indiana University law professor William Oliver. When his winemaking outgrew hobby status, he worked to pass the Indiana Small Winery Act in 1971. A year later, he opened his own winery. His son Bill Oliver took over in 1983. First, it's off to the Creek Bend Vineyard, located in south central Indiana, Monroe County. The vineyard opened in 1994, and in addition to the Catawba grapes, they grow Vidal, Chambersin, and Cabernet Sauvignon. Driving up the gravel road, it's grape vines as far as the eye can see, covering 54 acres of rolling hills.
We gotta find Bernie. Who knows where Bernie is? Bernie Parker's our vineyard manager.
He's the man we need.
He's the man that we need to talk to.
Today is a harvest day at the vineyard, so the 7 regular workers are joined by an additional 60 people snipping bunches of grapes off the vine and tossing them into lugs.
Hi.
I'm Annie.
Yes, nice to meet you. I'm Bernie.
Vineyard manager Bernie Parker is hoping to pick 16 tons of grapes before lunchtime today. The workers are picking Catawba grapes to be used for a rosé. It's maroon in color, and the darker the grape gets, the sweeter it tastes. The Catawba plant is hardy and can withstand hot and humid summers as well as very cold winters, exactly the climate in Indiana. Parker says this is actually the latest they've ever picked the Catawba crop, thanks to the unseasonably warm weather in October.
We actually go through and put hands-on the plant somewhere between 7 and 10 times a year, depending on how much rain we get. With 54 acres, that's right around, 34,000 plants. So, yeah.
Busy.
We're busy, just constantly.
These are really hard, where they get up really close to the branches.
One of the 60 seasonal recruits today is Grace Marie White, who's been harvesting grapes at the Creek Bend Vineyard for 5 years. She's paid by the lug, which is the plastic box the bunches of grapes are collected in. White is hoping to fill 20 lugs today, so at $2 per lug, that would be $40 for 4 hours of work.
You gotta make sure you don't hit the vines, the woody part, or cut too deep into these.
What would happen if you did that?
It kills off the vines. Next year, no grapes. No work, no money.
Yeah, so you've been doing it for so long, you're a pro probably.
I've been doing it a while. I'm not as fast as most of them out here. But I try not to damage the vines. I have used to have grapes of my own, so.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, but I made jelly.
You did? Nice. So are there certain grapes that you're making sure to leave on, or are you just plucking all of them off?
Green ones, and if they smell like vinegar.
So you're using your eyes and your nose for this today?
Yeah.
Do you ever steal any grapes to taste?
Yeah.
I won't tell anybody, don't worry.
Yeah.
The life cycle of the grapes at Creek Bend start in April when the plants start to bud. The vines flower and grapes start growing in May and June. That's when Parker and his team do most of the canopy management and quality control. The grapes go through veraison, that's the onset of ripening, and then they sweeten up in early August. And then the picking happens throughout the fall. But of course, all of this is dependent on the weather.
Well, in all actuality, right here in South Central Indiana, Monroe County, we are in a climatic zone that has the equivalent of growing degree days as Napa Valley. So we can actually ripen the grapes really well. One thing that we have that Napa Valley doesn't is 40 inches of rain some years, and they normally only have about 4 inches of rain a year.
All that rain isn't necessarily a good thing. With it comes some serious problems for the plants.
Powdery mildew, downy mildew, we have leaf phylloxera. Basically, because of our climate here, we have to put some fungicides on. What I do is I keep close track of the weather, and most of the fungicides that we put on are protectants. So if we have weather coming in, I'll put them on. We really try and manage it so that we put on the least amount of chemicals as possible, but they have certain shelf lives as far as how long they'll last on the vine. And these vines grow anywhere from 6 to 12 inches in 10 days. So everything that has grown has no protection since the last time we sprayed.
How ridiculously intensive would it be to have this as an organic functioning vineyard?
In Indiana, it's not possible, not on this scale.
Just because the diseases are just too rampant?
Yes, I mean, the organic chemicals that you would have to put on and the amount of chemicals you would have to use would be more harmful to the environment than, what we already use.
And if it's not one thing, it's another. Parker also has to fight off grape-loving animals.
Robins this year were just unbelievable. Never seen the flocks of robins that we've had this year. I don't know why.
They found the place when we were like, call everybody we know, jackpot.
Yeah, they hit the jackpot. And so, you know, normally with birds, we've got scare-eye balloons, which are these large 18, 24-inch round balloons with silver mylar eyes on them. We put mylar tape up, which is a silver and red shiny tape. We also have a bird distress signals that are electronic bird distress calls. This year, because of the robins, we added in a propane cannon. And we try not to go that direction, just so that it doesn't bother the neighbors too much.
What do the neighbors think about that?
Yeah, they understand. Bill and his father have been growing grapes here since the 1960s, so they know what the situation is.
Mm-hmm. So let's look ahead to November, December, January. We might have a whole lot of snow and temperatures are going to be very, very cold. So what's your job during the cold months?
Each of these vines has to be pruned by hand. We do a mechanical pruning, which basically does a rough cut and gets all the stuff that is sticking way out. But we go through and prune back each of the vines to a certain number of what we call nodes, and that's where the leaves have grown. About 95% of all of this year's growth will be cut off. Probably just about, you know, one shoot every 4 to 5 inches coming off that is about 6 inches long will be all that's left.
You can see photos of Bernie Parker and Grace Marie White and get a real feel for life at the vineyard on our website, eartheats.org. The grapes are then transported the 15 minutes from the vineyard to the tasting room and winemaking facility.
So we just brought Creek Bend pumpkins from our pumpkin patch out at the vineyard. So our tasting room is just, there's just an abundance of pumpkins and gourds and heirloom squash. Just this really neat time right now. Dennis, this is Annie Corrigan.
Hi, nice to meet you. Oh, you want to go out here and look at the grapes?
Dennis Dunham is a winemaker at Oliver. Today, he's processing some grapes that were harvested yesterday.
Catawba is one of the neatest varietals that we grow. It's just so unique. It's so different compared to most that we have out there. The flavors, the best I can come to describing them is watermelon Jolly Ranchers, or sometimes I almost get like a cotton candiness out of them, which doesn't even make sense to myself. But
and they have like 6 or 7 baby pits in there.
Oh, yeah.
Eat with care.
Yeah, you gotta spit those out.
Well, Dennis and I work closely together. There are different types of wines that you want different fruit qualities out of the vineyard. Sometimes you want to pick some grapes earlier so that you get a little more acidity, a little brighter, fresher fruit. And so, you know, we'll manage that crop a little bit differently than if something that he wants really ripe for dry red wines.
Dunham and the winemakers collaborate with Parker and the vineyard folks to decide everything from when to drop some of the crop to when to expose the fruit more by pulling some of the leaves.
And then ultimately what becomes really important at the end of the season is when you actually decide to harvest. You know, a week can make a big difference. And we just went through a couple weeks ago a time where it looked like we might be done because it got down to into the 60s and even into the 50s. And really the chemistry in the fruit in the vineyard stopped moving, as well as the flavor development stopped. And, you know, we kind of made the choice at that time. We could have picked that fruit and certainly have made wine from it. And we made the choice to, let's wait. It can't stay this cold. We are due some warm weather. So we actually had to wait a good 10 to 14 days. And then we've gotten this nice set of weather where 80s, perfect ripening weather, dry, sunny, and we saw, you know, that fruit just kind of took a little vacation on ripening and then came right back to it. And we're really happy that we made that decision. That was an important decision for us.
So now we get down to business. The grapes start their journey from fruit to wine by being run through the destemmer crusher.
The way it works, there's some holes the grapes can find. They come down, go in through two little paddles, and we're just going to split the berry open to begin liberating that juice. And you can tell these grapes have color on them. They're I describe them as a dark pink. We're treating this like a white wine, however, so we'll press this immediately. We won't ferment on the skins, and I think we'll see when we go over to the press. We do extract a little bit of color anyway from these skins.
Dunham says the name crusher is misleading because liberating the juice is actually a really gentle process. From here, they get tossed around in a round canister called the press. Again, the goal is to just get the juice out without grinding any of the seeds or mashing the skins.
So now this big pile of grape goo is from yesterday, you said?
We'd call this... In the industry, this is pomace right now, so it's the grapes and skins after all the stuff that we want has been taken out of it, which is essentially the juice.
Talk about what's going to happen to this pile of basically non-usable material.
This is this pile. You know, interestingly, we've had interest from people in creams and skins that want to use the grapeseed oil. I have no good way of storing big piles of this here without it becoming a big stinky mess for customers. But so what happens to it as it goes back out to the vineyard and becomes part of the soil again?
It starts the whole process all over. So remind me where we've gotten this juice.
We just got this juice after it went through the destemmer crusher. So the stems have just been freshly removed from it. It was split open in the crusher to start liberating the juice. And this, we just got this out of the drain pan out of the press. So the press is running in circles and just letting the juice come to the bottom. We would call this juice free run.
After tasting the grape itself, this really does, it tastes like the liquid version of the grape that I tasted.
Yeah. There are flavors in the skins that are kind of, you're separating the seeds out of there, and the seeds have some flavor. So the juice is a lot more of a treat, I suppose. You've got some of that kind of bitterness removed from it already, and you're just down to the good stuff in the juice.
After this, the juice will go straight from the press into a tank where it will be chilled. That's in order to hold off fermentation while the solids in the juice settle. After a week or so, they can then start fermentation on a cleaner juice.
So then let's look ahead to the future. When would I be drinking a bottle of this wine?
This wine, you could be drinking this bottle of wine before Christmas for sure. I'm hoping to bottle this in early part of December.
So it just doesn't really have to age all that long.
Not this particular wine. There's nothing really that is going to benefit it by aging. The majority of our wines are fruit forward. Our winemaking style is to make wines that taste like the fruit that they're made from. As most people know, with fruit, if you leave fruit sitting around a long time, it at some point doesn't begin to taste like what you hoped that fruit tasted like. It's really kind of the same with winemaking. We have a lot of the technology that we have, the clarification that we have is an effort to clean this wine up and get it ready to bottle in a pretty accelerated state, so that what that does for us is we don't have wine sitting around in tanks waiting, which is just time that bad things that can happen to the wine.
Our tour today wouldn't have been complete without doing at least a little bit of tasting. Dunham cracked open a bottle of the Catawba sparkling wine, obviously made from the same variety of grape that was picked and processed today.
So if you'll notice the lack of sweetness compared to the juice here, amazingly, if we tasted this without tasting the juice first, you would pick up some subtle sweetness. But compared to the juice, this is tasting pretty dry right now. But the fruit, the flavors are all still there. They're certainly lingering behind in this sparkling, and I think it's a really nice example of what our winemaking style is as far as taking these flavors and getting them all the way to the bottle, to the customers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Dunham suggests serving this sparkling with some light cheeses and raspberries. You can read more about the Oliver Winery's philosophy and check out all the different wines they offer on their website, oliverwinery.com. Bonin was saying that Oliver's Valdiguier is especially good for mulling, and who doesn't love a good mulled wine this time of year? This is a great thing to do with cheap wine, or maybe wine that isn't the tastiest, but Chef Daniel Orr is going to use some good wine for us today.
And basically it's the same ingredients for the mulled wine and a hot apple cider. So what we have here is I've got about three bottles. We're expecting a lot of people to come in tonight. Three bottles of red wine here. All right, we're going to add about 2 cups of brown sugar, and we're going to add some honey. Okay, and now we're just going to add our spices. What we're going to do to make this easier to serve, so you don't have a bunch of UFOs flying around in your mulled cider, is that we're going to take cheesecloth and make a sachet out of it. So we've got some Au Poivre blend, which is a blend of 5 peppercorns. We've got some cloves, some star anise, and star anise is that really nice Asian ingredient that tastes a lot like licorice, and if you smell this, it's got that really nice sweet licorice-y flavor. I've got some bay leaves, a little bit of coriander seeds, some fennel seeds, a couple big hunks of ginger.
And your favorite ginger.
Yeah, and some cardamom, some cinnamon sticks, which I just like to break up just a little bit. And we're going to put some thyme. Now, this is some thyme that I got out of my garden right before the first big heavy freeze came. Put that in the refrigerator in a Ziploc bag with a little bit of wet paper towel, and it's kept for about a month and a half. And now we're just going to tie this up.
Oh, it's a little package.
Squeeze that together, and then I've got some butcher's twine here. We're going to leave the string a little bit longer on one side so we can tie it to the side of the pot. And we're just going to sink that in there. I'm going to float some nice oranges on top of this.
You let that mull for 45 minutes to an hour. Your house will smell amazing by the time it's ready to drink. But just wait, the presentation for this drink is really the best part.
The way I like to serve this is to take my little drink glass, and you want to use a very heat-resistant glassware or mug. What we're going to do is we're just going to dip it in a little bit of that honey, and then we're going to dip this into cinnamon sugar.
Oh, look at that.
And you've got a nice little spiced rimmed glass.
The alcohol does cook off, so if you want to add a splash of vodka to this before serving, that would be an option. All of the herbs and spices taste great, and they do some great things for the body as well. The star anise combats gas and headaches, and the cloves contain anti-inflammatory properties. The mace stimulates the brain, and the ginger increases circulation. So there you go. You can find this recipe on our website, along with recipes from our contributors, like Clara Moore's homemade mustard and marinated olives. Those would make great holiday gifts this year for sure. Thanks to all the folks at the Oliver Winery, including Pam Bonin, Bernie Parker, Grace Marie White, and Dennis Dunham. Thanks to Chef Daniel Orr for the tasty mulled wine. Liz Leslie and Sarah Gordon write our news stories. And Eabon Binder and Sia Africa manage EarthEats.org. Enjoy your holiday weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.